Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mona, you know, now that Biden is in office, everyone would think that they have, well, Mona's magical wand, right? They wave it and everything is fixed. But I know that people are still living with delays in immigration, right?
This is a huge, huge issue, Mark. And yes, happy inauguration week, as we call it. It was a glorious day and it's wonderful, but nothing has been fixed overnight. Unfortunately, we are seeing all kinds of issues. And this is really the subject of our podcast today, because there is a lot of frustration, a lot of angst out there. I really want to give an opportunity to Rebecca and to Joey to really vent today.
That's right, Mona. We have a lot of energy and a lot of passion. And luckily, there's going to be a lot of action on today's show. And helping us with that is Joey, aka Joseph Barnett. He's an attorney at Wolfsdorf Rosenthal, where he represents immigrant investors pursuing EB-5 through regional centers or investment in their own businesses. He also works with U.S.-based businesses and developers, economists, securities lawyers, and others to prepare regional centers' applications, amendments, and project exemplar approvals. And I know he and his firm has felt these delays as well as Mona Shaw & Associates. So it sounds like it's a team up and take them down, right?
It is. Rebecca, this is different, right? It's not like our usual delays.
I think I speak for everyone who is dealing with USCIS at the moment. You're right. It's totally different from what we've seen in the past. And I can't emphasize enough how frustrated. I mean, again, we emphasize how frustrated we are with this department, USCIS, and how they're handling these unreasonably long delays. Joey, you know that we have seen our fair share of delays, right? It's immigration. And we understand now, right? We have the pandemic and we understand that delays have worsened through this time period. But now we're adding the sheer lack of response from USCIS. We're not just seeing it with I-526 petitions, which we've seen in our practice, but it's now affecting other aspects of the immigration process and it's heavily interfering in our clients' lives.
Absolutely. This is above and beyond the normal delay and discourage that has permeated immigration from Trump's administration and even, to be honest, a little bit beforehand.
It's not just our clients. I know we deal a lot with the EB-5 and hence the title of the podcast series, but it's for all immigration. As we're going to discuss further in the show, the different aspects, like we said, in the immigration process. And it's not affecting just EB-5 applicants. It's affecting everyone across the board.
Right, Joey, give us a few examples of what you are seeing.
The big thing that we're seeing that's impacting our investor EB-5 clients' lives, most impactfully, are these I-829 receipt notices. When you file your I-829, that extends your conditional green card period, but you need that receipt notice from the government as evidence of your lawful status in the United States. Wow. And we are not getting these receipt notices issued in a timely manner. And it's causing a whole bunch of problems and frustrations for our clients.
What's the usual time that you do see it?
In normal times, we would get them in anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks or so after filing. Nowadays, we have cases where we filed in late October or early November. And, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 weeks later, we still don't have them. Yeah, I mean, Rebecca, I think you are sort of having a similar situation, right? I mean, it's not just our firm; it's a systematic thing.
Yes, it's across the board. We have applications that have been filed since September of 2020. I've spoke with other attorneys who have had files, I think, since July of 2020.
Rebecca and Joey, both of your firms are feeling this, but what does it really mean? You're talking about previously there was about a 2 to 4 week wait cycle, and now we're talking up to 12 weeks, possibly longer. Joey, you mentioned your clients are frustrated, but what does that really mean? How does this impact them? are they not able to do that they should have been able to do in a timely manner before?
Absolutely. They're unable to travel. They're unable to work. They may be unable to get extensions on their driver's license. These are really big daily essential things that they didn't sign up for when they applied for EB-5. You know,
effectively move around in the U.S. They can't continue to work. And if they have family outside the U.S., which many of them do, right? They can't travel outside.
No, it's essentially a complete cessation of whatever their situation is. I was on a call with Rebecca. I actually was in listen-only mode, and the client was in tears. Frontline COVID workers.
I can see why.
Yeah, they've been told by the hospital, and the hospital are desperate to keep them, but they've been told by the hospital, you can't work here anymore because we have no way of knowing that you are in status.
Exactly. And so I want to emphasize the frustration of not getting these receipt notices and that they're, you know, it's detrimental to our clients and their lives and working. Like you said, Mona, some of these are frontline workers. And not only that, they need to support their families. They've been here in the U.S. for so long. You know, they're on these conditional green cards. And for them to not be able to carry that on or have any document to show their authorization to stay and work here, it's a mess.
So previously, if somebody had not got a receipt notice, Rebecca, what usually happened? What would we do?
So what we do with our clients is that we have our own checks that go with the application. We get a copy of the check and we will see the WAC number on there. And then from there, we're able to communicate a lot better with USCIS to say, look, we didn't get a receipt notice, or we'll find other ways to be sure that we can actually show that authorization for them to stay in the U.S.
What, you telling me that USCIS are not cashing checks? Joey, are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, to be honest, I consider it pretty pathetic when you have paid thousands of dollars to file this application and it's just sitting there. I think this is happening a lot in Texas. It's not just happening with 829s. It's happening with adjustment of status applications. It's happening with employment authorization document extensions.
Yeah.
And it's a huge issue for a lot of people in and outside of EB-5.
Now, this is all under the Trump administration, because I really want to emphasize that, yes, Joe Biden was brought in, but his team is not brought in yet, and USCIS still hasn't changed over. So we're still dealing with all of the guidance under the Trump administration. Is that right, Joey?
Yeah, absolutely. And as much as I don't like giving the Stephen Miller-led USCIS the benefit of the doubt, I think there has been somewhat of like a perfect storm related to COVID, related to maybe some of the budget issues surrounding USCIS and having these offices closed and the backlog that's created. But, you know, most of the world has been able to figure out how to work with these restrictions in a safe way. You know, you guys, I imagine, have your offices open as necessary to file cases.
Yeah,
we do as well. And so it's just making the appropriate arrangements so that you can carry out your business. And for these EB-5 investors, I mean, I know you guys feel the same way with your clients. It's been a struggle to be there and to provide a shoulder to lean on, because it's something that's happening to everybody.
I think it's also frustrating for us as lawyers, because we really can't work on anything, in the sense that every single day we are dealing with some upset client, and you know, they have the right to be upset.
Absolutely. I mean, and one option that can be is calling 1-800-USCIS, trying to get an update or do a case inquiry, trying to get some more information.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So both of you tell me, and Joe, you can start first, and then Rebecca, you can explain, what is the first step? One of our clients is, we filed a petition, we've not got a receipt notice, we've not got any response from anything for months and months. What are you doing?
The first thing that we try to do, like Rebecca mentioned, is we got to see if they've cashed the check. Our office is the same, and that we do our best to make sure that we can find the receipt notice once they cash the check. If that doesn't happen, working with an InfoPass USCIS officer, our office always calls it 1-800-USELESS, not 1-800-USCIS, because it normally doesn't provide too much information. But sometimes you are able to get a helpful officer, and they may be able to schedule an InfoPass appointment where you are able to get a I-551 stamp put in your passport.
But that hasn't been the case lately?
Yeah, I'm going to take a step back there, Joey. I mean, like you said, maybe once in a while we'll get something from an officer online, but I can't stress how long, first of all, it takes to get an officer on the phone.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We ourselves own it. Yeah, just our office, we're on the phone for hours at a time. Sometimes they don't get back to us after 24 hours. And this is just to speak with an officer. And then, like you said, if you want to make an InfoPass appointment, they then put schedule in for another call to schedule the InfoPass appointment. So I remember one time it took us 7 days just to speak to someone, and we still have not received any information to get an InfoPass appointment.
And I mean, in those situations where there's emergencies and, you know, maybe your grandma is on her deathbed abroad, you know, waiting those 7 days, that's unacceptable, you know?
Can an investor just go, or can a client just go to the office themselves?
No. At this time, no. You have to make an InfoPass appointment, either calling USCIS and scheduling the appointment. We used to be able, a long time ago, we used to be able to make the appointment online and then just print out your receipt notice. You could get an appointment like that. Now it's days. You know, if you have to go in an emergency, you're waiting at least 2 weeks before seeing an officer.
Is this, Joey, across the board? Or, I mean, are you seeing this only in California? That's where your office is. Is this everywhere?
It seems to be in most places. I do think there are some location relevant or dependent issues, you know, in LA where there's thousands of people who are looking for these appointments. The dates definitely get pushed back a lot more than, you know, there may be in the middle of the country. But I do think this is something that is happening all over the place. At least that's what happens with our clients. And they are able to call USCIS on their own, or they come to us and they ask us to call USCIS. But it's something that we try to do in coordination so that there isn't any delays in responding by USCIS or getting some sort of like rejection because you've already submitted a request within the past 30 days. I mean, Rebecca, what do you do in those situations when a client has already contacted USCIS?
Yes, I agree with you 100%. We try to coordinate. If they've contacted USCIS, we do wait the full 30 days before making another inquiry. We have been told off by an officer that, you know, we have to wait. We can't put in another, you know, can't put in another appointment date or any of that. You have to make sure that you coordinate together so that you're not overstepping in any way.
So we've had some employers actually ask us whether or not they would get into trouble or whether there was any issue in continuing the employment of one of their employees just because they don't have a notice, a receipt notice. What advice are you guys giving?
Here's the thing. Technically, especially when it comes to the I-829, because you're a conditional green card holder, you are a permanent resident. You have the right to continue on that permanent residence until you get a notification that you're no longer, you know, if you get denied or anything that happens, if you get thrown into court. The problem is that we have to look at it realistically. And our clients are complaining because their employers are not seeing it that way. And how can you argue? And Joanna, you said your firm writes letters as well, but is it really helping? I've seen a lot of clients who were fired because they don't have any proof to show that they are authorized to work in the U.S.
We're seeing the same thing, and as much as we can to, you know, talk with their HR, write letters, show them the regulations, they're covering their backsides as well and making sure that they're doing everything to comply with U.S. immigration law from the employer side. And so for the most part, yeah, we have unfortunately seen some of our clients get laid off. And you know, this isn't just getting the initial 829 receipt notice. This also is coming up, I would imagine, for your clients too, Rebecca. Once that 18 months has passed, that notice is no longer good to show their evidence and their evidence of conditional green card status and their ability to work.
You know, Joey, you mentioned that the I-551 stamp earlier. I know it's a little basic, but just if there's any listener online, what is an I-551 stamp and when would you normally expect to receive it?
Yep. An I-551 stamp is evidence of your conditional green card status. It's put into your passport. For the most part, they will only issue an I-551 stamp for 1 year, or if your passport isn't valid for that 1 year, up until the end of your passport. And so really that is what is used by conditional green card holders to travel in and out of the United States and as evidence to work once that 18-month extension is up.
Yeah. So I simplistically, what I tell my clients, it's equivalent to, you know, everyone wants to see that physical green card, you know, the actual permanent residence card. And the I-551 stamp is equivalent to that. It's just as good. And what we've seen is for our clients who are outside of the U.S. who are first entering, you do receive that stamp upon entry. And that is when you become a permanent resident as of that day. What we have seen is that, like you said, Joe, you see clients who are getting 1 year extensions with that stamp. What we are seeing is the officers in their own discretion now are stamping for only 3 or 4 months. And if we're getting all these delays with USCIS, I mean, realistically, if it's taking 6 months to produce the actual physical green card, where does that leave our client? You're again, wasting time making InfoPass appointments, having to be on the phone. And I mean,
And Rebecca, another point some of our clients have been complaining about is that they're not getting driving licenses issued because their I-51 stamp is not for a year.
Exactly. And that's why I want to stress again, is the frustration these clients are having to go through. And we're helping them all the way through and doing as much as we can possible and working with USCIS and making sure this gets through. But I hope this administration now, you know, unfortunately, you know, his administration, immigration is still in there, but they see how it's hurting our clients and the humanity.
It's really hurting. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. By the way, before I ask about the next steps, what are we seeing at the consulate? Are we seeing delays?
Well, the consulates are closed at the moment. We're slowly seeing some reopening. We just saw the other day, Mona, you saw the email. One of our clients is having an interview scheduled 2 weeks from now in Vietnam. So it's a good sign that we see that the consulates are opening, but it's still going to have delays just because they're backlogged from being closed all these months.
Yeah,
we're seeing delays at the consulate. We're seeing delays at cases getting transferred from USCIS to the National Visa Center, so that they can issue the fee bill. I mean, I think at every step of the process, there seem to be delays that are impacting people.
Right. From what I'm hearing, it seems like it's delays, delays, delays. It's hard to get a hold of somebody. And then once somebody actually can stamp the documents needed, they only do it for a few months out. It seems like they're making the problem harder on themselves.
Actually, Mark, I was going to answer that. What we have been seeing also is that there's a number of our clients who've gone to local congressmen and senators' offices to try and get some assistance here, because after doing umpteen info passes and calls, that seems to be the next step. And what we are being told from the various congressional staff is that there is a deliberate policy at this point of just delaying until the Biden administration is able to take over. But I just don't understand why USCIS don't see what kind of hardship they're causing.
Exactly.
Yeah, Joey, Rebecca, what about the ombudsman? Is that an option?
It's an option. It's one that I don't use very often because I don't feel like it's too helpful. But I think it does raise the issue to a quasi-independent agency, which sort of has been formed to address issues and sort of systematic problems within USCIS. And you can get a case number, but it does take some time. I mean, Rebecca, I think you may have some more experience with this than I do.
Yeah, so we have used the ombudsman in the past, and we've used it where, for instance, an I-45 application has been pending. And a lot of times we get that they're looking into the client's background, but it's, you know, 2 years plus that it's pending. The ombudsman has helped in that situation.
Yeah, you're right, Rebecca. I remember when we started the show almost 5 years ago, we did an episode actually advocating for contacting the ombudsman and everything they can do. What you're telling me is that no longer the case?
Good memory, Mark.
I've been doing this a while.
Yeah,
but that's not the case anymore?
Yeah, it's what's happening is that with the ombudsman, it's great having them because they're independent from USCIS. Problem is, it takes 90 days for the ombudsman to get back to you and to look into your case and to figure out what is actually happening. So for instance, as we're discussing the I-829 petitions, where we're not receiving the receipt notices, our clients cannot wait 3 months just to get information from the ombudsman that they're looking into the case, and then take another 3 months to actually figure out what's going on.
And then to Joey's point, maybe they give it a stamp that's only good for like 90 hours or 90 seconds. I don't know. It's frustrating.
It is.
Frustrating.
Not only are we seeing delays with the I-829 receipts, we're also seeing delays with the employment authorization documents and the advance parole.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yes, we are. This is potentially even worse than the 829 issues. I mean, we have cases that were filed back in March of 2020, 10 months ago, and they still haven't gotten their EADs, or potentially they haven't even gotten their biometrics. And these are people who are in the United States lawfully, and they're no longer able to work. It's terrible for these people.
Even after standing outside and marching up and down USCIS offices, and please, if anyone from USCIS is listening, please help. The best that we can do right now is just empathize with our clients, which is so not satisfactory.
No, not at all. And they're patient. They're being very patient, Mona. We can't thank them enough. And we're doing everything possible to help them through this.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you go and you buy a movie ticket and you get there. And you get your popcorn and you sit down in your seat, and then you kind of just sit there and wait for the previews to happen. And it's hours and hours and hours. It's frustratingly long.
Joey, I think I have sat in that same movie theater that you're talking about. I remember getting so upset that I got up out of my seat and I walked to the back of the movie theater wondering, what's going on? Where's my movie? It should be playing now.
After all of these efforts, usually the next solution is the judicial system. And first thing I'm going to ask both of you is, we've heard a lot about filing mandamus petitions. Even on this show, we've discussed this a couple of times. And I think a lot of our listeners would like to understand, first of all, are you able to file a mandamus petition, Joey, for something like an EAD petition or a receipt notice?
Yes, you are able to file a mandamus petition on an EAD document that has been unreasonably delayed. I would not be filing a mandamus action, though, on an I-829 receipt notice. Those are two separate actions.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're two separate, right? With the EAD, you have the application, it's pending. You have a reason to go to USCIS and say that it's unreasonably delayed. Whereas the I-829 receipt, you don't have any indication. All we have is a FedEx confirmation to say that it has been delivered to USCIS. So how do you bring a claim?
But if somebody's job is on the line, why can't we take that FedEx receipt and maybe an affidavit or somebody who showed that they put it into the FedEx and they were charged for it or paid for it or whatever, and go to court and say, this is hurting me. I've lost my job. I'm about to lose my job. I'm a frontline COVID worker.
I guess hypothetically, one could bring that claim. I don't know any lawyers that are doing that at this time. When you bring these types of claims, you have to show that they have a non-discretionary duty. I think they do probably have a duty to issue a receipt notice upon a timely filed application. And you have to show that they're not fulfilling that duty in an unreasonable amount of time. And that term, unreasonable amount of time, is sort of subject to discretion. And it's up to the lawyer to make the argument of why it is unreasonable. And if someone isn't able to continue working or isn't able to have their driver's license, then I guess there could be a claim there. It's just not one that I've seen to date.
Yeah, right. Well, I do want to say that there have been some frivolous mandamus petitions filed. I would like to spend a couple of moments on asking both of you, what are you seeing today? How are you using mandamus?
Well, Mona, you and I have discussed this plenty of times, and we err on the side of mandamus because we have seen the good, where we have...
You mean we err on the side of caution?
Oh, yes. We caution our clients when filing a mandamus because we have seen the good. We have seen approvals come in, but we have also seen terrible RFEs that actually hurt our clients more so than, you know, thinking that the mandamus is actually going to help them in the long run.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain circumstances where filing a mandamus is not a good idea. For example, if there's problems with a project, or if there's potential with age-out children and it may be better for the case to continue pending for a long period of time, then a mandamus may not be a good option. And you know, we've received calls, I mean, I think on a weekly basis from folks who filed their I-526 in October or November of 2019 saying, hey, I want to file this mandamus. I'm not taking those cases at this time. Those types of cases that have been pending for under 15 months or so, I'm not bringing those cases to a federal judge and saying, hey, that's unreasonably delayed.
But your firm is taking action right now because you're working with our firm on this. And I know we're reaching out to other firms who are in similar situations. So perhaps you could describe a little of that.
Sure. And we're so happy to be working with you guys on this. This project that we're working with relates to these employment authorization documents. Back in March of 2020, USCIS allowed Chinese nationals who were in the United States to file an adjustment of status based on Chart B in the visa bulletin. And we had a whole host of them file at that time. That was back in March. And still, many of them haven't been scheduled for their biometrics or haven't gotten their EAD. And now they've gotten to the point where they can't work in the United States. So moving forward with this mandamus, or it's really a claim under the Administrative Procedures Act for unreasonable delay, is a solution for them to get those EADs issued so that they can get back to work and support their family.
Yeah. And if I may say, the entire point of Chart B was so that as they're waiting to receive that conditional green card, they have some way to work and lawfully stay in the U.S. And if you can't even get that and it's taking over a year to get that, it was, what was the whole point of bringing that in?
Right.
Absolutely.
So I think USCIS needs to systematically change the way they're doing things. And like we said, we're reaching out. Please listen to us. We have to change the way things are happening there at the moment.
How many petitions are you looking to file at one time? Is it a class action, Joey, or something else?
It's not a class action, but we're joining multiple plaintiffs within the same lawsuit.
Not necessarily all Chinese, though, right?
Not necessarily all Chinese, no. It's the way that we have sort of been thinking about this. It is related to EB-5 investors who have filed adjustments, who are here in the United States lawfully. And, you know, my message to USCIS is stop making us use judicial resources and just adjudicate these on time. I mean, these people are hardworking individuals that deserve nothing less than what the rest of us in the United States are able to do.
No, well said. Yeah.
It's very, very frustrating for them. I mean, I was looking at the data that we compiled. The most recent EAD that we got for a case that was filed in March was issued 2 weeks ago. This guy had a biometrics appointment done in August.
Wow.
So it took them about 5 to 6 months after going in to get their fingerprints done to actually produce the card. I mean, these delays are just incredibly frustrating for people.
It's really at a time in COVID where people are even lucky to have jobs and the economy is sputtering. I think this deliberate act of delaying is simply unconscionable.
Exactly, Mona. And so for our clients, any of our listeners out there, please reach out to us. We're reaching out to individuals as well, but reach out to us, reach out to both of our firms so that way we can put you in the action and get this filed as soon as possible, the mandamus.
Yep. We've done this before. We've had success. Of course, success in the past doesn't always guarantee success in the future, but we feel very confident that these claims are viable. And that sometimes just by even filing the lawsuit, we're able to push the government to make an action. And that's what we've seen in the past for the most part. And we're very, very hopeful that we can do it again in the future.
Yeah. And these claims, hopefully they push the others as well. So hopefully it's just we file a few mandamus complaints and then USCIS hopefully gets their act together and it's able to go ahead and adjudicate the remaining EADs and advanced parole documents that are waiting out there.
Oh, I see what you're saying, Rebecca, much like a domino effect. So the people that are proactive and contact you and reach out and get some type of positive action, some forward movement in their case will actually help everybody else that's kind of hitting the backlog. So if you're listening to this episode right now, and I assume you are because you can hear my voice, right in the episode player, there is a link to the contact form for Mona Shaw and Associates. So you can contact us and get this going. If you're listening to us right on the webpage, well, the contact form is right there. Feel free to act on it. Again, not only could you possibly get a positive action and forward movement of your case, but you could help out some others as well. You know, I feel I've done my part. I voted Biden in, and I'm a Georgia resident, so I had to vote for Ossoff and Warnock twice in the general and then a special elections and runoffs. So I feel like I've done my part, but we can't wait for the Biden administration and the new 50-50 Senate mix to fix things for us. So Mona, Rebecca, Joey, I applaud all three of you for saying we can't wait any longer. This is what we're going to do to help our clients because they're feeling the pain. We feel the pain. Let's make the pain stop. So I thank you all for doing this and sharing the news on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure to be on here. I'm an avid listener to the podcast for many years, and you guys have put out some great content. And so it's truly a pleasure to be able to add to it. And I guess my closing comment on this is patience is not always a virtue. Sometimes you got to be the one to move life forward for yourself. And so that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.